You're listening to the Expansion Chronicles, a podcast about expansion of startups into the US. On this podcast, we talk about the main mistakes that founders make while trying to move from their home turf and build divisions of their companies in the US. We try to explain how to avoid these pitfalls and what tools can be helpful in this complicated process. So if you are a founder located outside of America and think of growing your company in the States, this podcast is definitely for you. So let's jump into the episode. And today's guest speaker, we have Stephen Cobb, co-founder and CEO at Opal. And in this episode, we'll talk about numerous things, one of which being how did Stephen found Opal and how did he stumble, as he says, upon this idea? And what are his plans for their Series A that they're raising right now? So Stephen, let's kick it off by you giving us some background on yourself and on Opal.
Yeah, totally. Constantine, thanks so much for having me. Super happy to be here. I studied computer science and I was a developer at Dropbox for several years. And when I left Dropbox, I knew I wanted to do a startup. And basically what, you know, I ended up connecting with my co-founder, who was sort of a friend of a friend. And we basically took about a month to just sort of founder date, where he and I would spend a lot of time together, just like working out of a co-working space, doing a combination of like researching ideas and also kind of like doing a lot of like values oriented exercises. Like, for instance, we read, you know, a bunch of books like, you know, the Founder's Dilemma or, you know, some of these other like negotiating books. And we had a lot of conversations about them, get a sense of what was important to us, and how we kind of just gel together. And, you know, in parallel to reading all these books and learning sort of just about startups generally, we were also like researching a bunch of startup ideas. And, you know, this was, you know, my co-founder, Nassim, he's awesome. He's a really startup oriented person. And so we had a really systematic way of trying to figure out what we wanted to do. We basically like, you know, picked about 10, you know, investors, institutional firms and angels that had like really, really good performance over the last like, you know, 5 years, and basically just looked at everything they'd funded on Crunchbase in the last 6 months. And from there, that sort of like, you know, generated a lot of like ideas for us. And one space that came up a lot was like software security. And so we were sort of, we were talking to a lot of people, and someone suggested that like, you know, we look at basically SSH key management. And, you know, this instantly triggered a lot of like firsthand like memories for me and Nassim. You know, Nassim used to work at MuleSoft, I worked at Dropbox, and we had both dealt with like a lot of access management pain. And at Dropbox, we had a tool for access management, and that tool was pretty good, but, you know, no one wanted to work on it. It was like, you know, constantly like under maintained. And so it felt like going into sort of the access management space, based on the fact that we had had firsthand pain with it, based on the fact that, you know, Dropbox had this internal tool and that was like sort of a good starting point from a product spec perspective. That was sort of how, you know, I met my co-founder and ended up in sort of the access management space.
Lovely. I love your approach of founder dates. That sounds awesome. That sounds super interesting. And that sounds like a structured approach to learning about the being a startup founder. That is really interesting. Any advice to other startup founders here who are maybe just in the beginning of their journey, who maybe have not read as many books as you did? Any advice there? Any of your favorite books that you would just like to recommend on the spot here?
I think, you know, my biggest piece of advice, I mean, just based on my own experience, and it's a, you know, it's a data point of one, but you know, so much of the last, you know, year and a half for me has been, you know, much more of, I'd say, an emotional struggle than necessarily a technical struggle or like a product or business struggle. Like, you know, those are all, you know, all those categories of problems are really hard. They're really important, but, you know, there's just so many ups and downs to doing a startup that, you know, picking that person that not only has like a, you know, a complementary or reinforcing skill set to you, but also someone that is, that you're like very emotionally on the same page with and you gel with well interpersonally, I think is incredibly important. You know, as far as books, Yeah, I mean, I think that the founder's dilemma is honestly the one that stands out the most to me. That was just such a great, such a great overview of all the sorts of like decision points that you're likely to reach as a founder. And, you know, the biggest one of which is like, you know, are you sort of like control oriented or value oriented? Namely, are you trying to, you know, preserve as much control over your startup as possible, or basically, you know, enrich the shareholders as much as possible? And I really liked that sort of framing. And yeah, I thought that was just a really, really great overview. Never Split the Difference by, you know, Chris Voss is kind of the classic negotiation book. I thought that was good, you know, for just like everything from life to like just leadership to, you know, sales, like, you know, this idea of basically, you know, having a very empathetic but firm approach to negotiating, you know, where you help, you know, you basically ensure that the other person feels that you are hearing them and understand them, but you also kind of like maintain your own stance very, very, very firmly. I thought that was a very useful book as well.
Yeah. What title of the book is that again?
It's called Never Split the Difference. Mm-hmm. It's by this, like, this is a book that Elson Nassim recommended to me. It's by this FBI, I think, a hostage negotiator. And so his sorts of negotiations were much higher stakes than most people. And so he's got a very interesting perspective, but he takes you through all these different scenarios, whether you're negotiating with your like romantic partner, or you're negotiating with like a used car salesman. Mm-hmm. Like so many of these different interactions, like require the same foundation of like, you know, the other person feeling heard by you, you know, and how important that is in negotiation. I really like that a lot.
Yeah. Lovely. For people who have extremely short memory like I do, I'll include those books in the description of this episode, so check them out if you think it sounds applicable to you. Let's go back to talking about early stage founders who are listening to this episode right now. Founders who just come up with ideas like you did with a pal, they frequently struggle with the early stages, like first year, 2 years, especially with testing out the viability of the idea. I've seen both founders who have just failed to test it and just decided that, you know, by default it's viable and I'm gonna put a year and a half into development, and then they just fail and it's sad. So in your case, how did you test out the viability of the idea that you came up with your co-founder?
Yeah, that's a great question. So our investor Greylock from the very beginning was like, look, you need to find design partners to basically iterate with as early as possible. And so we rushed out some mocks, UI mocks. So we were funded kind of pre-product, right? And so we didn't, you know, we only had kind of a rough sense of the product that we wanted to build, the space we wanted to be in. So we rushed out basically, not design mocks, I guess a UI. We built a UI. And a UI with no backend. And basically the idea was, you know, we started like soliciting a lot of companies to basically give us a sense of whether or not if this product were fully implemented, would they want this? And, you know, there's no substitute for just building the product. There really isn't, because initially, one thing that we had is we had a lot of really big companies that were interested in this at like a theoretical level. Like they, like, you know, it's a pretty low bar to agree to be someone's like design partner. And so we had a lot of companies be our design partners, but then when we finally like had built it out, which took, you know, and honestly took us probably about 8-9 months. A lot of it was focused on, I mean, probably 3 or 4 of those months were spent on discovery. And then probably 4 months spent on building. We hired 2 people. And so there's, you know, between my co-founder and me and the 2 people we hired, there were 4 developers. It still took a while. Our product is like fairly complex. And then what we had happen was we just got a bunch of no's, you know, which was like, honestly, that was the lowest point. It was we had been grinding on, you know, the startup for, you know, 10 months now, 9 months. We finally were in a position to get it in people's hands. And when push came to shove, you know, it's one thing to be someone's design partner. It's another thing to like, you know, actually use the product. And so I don't know what we could have done differently. I think we could have built the product sooner and just run, like the sorts of like business relationships that have worked the best for us is where we have a company that is basically iterating with us. And so they're interested enough where they've like created a list of like features on a spreadsheet. And every week we build like, you know, a few of those features and then have them test it out and then, you know, see if they like it, see if they don't. Like we're at that point now. Of course, like, you know, we're doing that sort of iteration on top of a foundation of like a already built existing product. But I'm looking at those relationships and those are so productive and they're so grounded in reality. And so basically the sooner you can get to that MVP, the better. And then you can find a couple of customers that aren't interested in a high level, but are interested in very specific features. And one other thing I'll say is just the, you know, everyone's going to say this, but buyer is very important, right? Our product has a lot of appeal for compliance folks, but, you know, compliance budget is usually not as big as like eng budget. And as a result, you know, compliance's clout is usually not as big as eng's. And so we would have champions on the compliance team that, you know, really wanted to see our product adopted, but the users and the people with the most budget, the eng teams, they're often pretty happy with their internal tools. And so making sure that you get all the kind of stakeholders and decision makers involved in the process was kind of that was a lesson that we learned, because we made that mistake by not involving eng enough, because compliance were the sort of the champions. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Got it. To be fair, I didn't understand quite a few words there. So let's get back to the subject that I do personally understand, which is fundraising. And let's talk about your the thing that you mentioned earlier in this episode, which lost my voice there, which was that you raised money pre-product. Yeah. How exactly did that happen? How did you get to know that investor? And why were they so eager to invest? And my voice is gone. Yep.
Oh, hang in there, Constantine. Yeah, so I think we got lucky. I think my co-founder and I are like a strong team. And so, you know, part of the bet was on the team. The investor that invests in us, like, is a partner at Greylock that I actually knew from school. And so that helped, certainly. There's a, you know, a personal foundation there. But I think the overriding reason is you know, our partner wanted, and we saw this from other investors too. They like want to bet on the space, you know, like space first and foremost. In some cases, you know, at least in this case, it felt like the access management space was a space that a lot of people just think is sort of broken. And so placing a bet on the space first and foremost, and then a bet on the team, and then, you know, in sort of as an afterthought or tertiary part of this, we came up with some like design mocks and things like that for the product. And we interviewed probably like 50 companies. And so we had a pretty good idea of the product we wanted to build, but it wasn't built at all. Yeah. So I would say we got lucky and it was like good timing. And, you know, there's like a personal connection with the investor and, but also just, yeah, the team, I think our team was strong.
100%. Definitely think that investors, first of all, invest in the teams, and then, you know, hopefully the team works in the right space, but might go both ways. So let's talk about the round that you're raising right now, and specifically, what is the major difference between raising your pre-seed and Series A? How, from your personal perspective right now, what are the major differences there?
Yeah. So, I mean, the difference between the seed and the Series A. So one thing is, so my co-founder Nassim actually left the company about 6 months ago. And he basically had an amazing opportunity come up in kind of the cryptocurrency space. His brother, created a coin that was, you know, or in a protocol is very, very valuable. And so he basically wanted to build a company on top of his brother's protocol, which is really cool. So the big difference is that, you know, so Nassim was the CEO before. And basically, you know, when we were fundraising during the seed, like he was the one pitching. And so the biggest difference for me personally is that, you know, I've been pitching, in the Series A. In terms of what investors are looking for, you know, the emphasis, you know, I mean, Seed is like, you know, really about like the team and the potential. And, you know, it might, in our case, it was pre-product. So obviously revenue numbers weren't kind of factored into that decision. Whereas now, I mean, it's still, I can't speak for, I'm no like expert on the space as a whole, but the sense that I've gotten, you know, for the investor landscape in, you know, during Series A is, you know, the emphasis is a little bit more on traction. Narrative is still a big part of it. Where what is the vision you have for the product? Is the team strong? Who are the sorts of customers you've closed? Yeah, but you know, but it's still also a bet on the space too. And so I think the sorts of conversations are like are a lot more focused on, you know, go-to-market strategy and the like underlying business metrics. Whereas in the Seed, it's for us, it was just very, it was all very hypothetical and mm-hmm. focused much more on the product vision itself.
Yeah. Absolutely. And my voice is not coming back, so just ignore it. So let's talk about the pitching. You said that you started pitching in your Series A. Yeah. Any advice for founders who have never pitched before and maybe they're earlier on in the process? Any advice there, maybe to fight anxiety or, you know, every single founder who has their first pitch in front of a real investor, that's going to be pretty scary. So any advice there for them?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, you know, of course, all the standard advice around, you know, practicing a lot. I mean, it's your slide deck. I think the slides are really important to just like anchoring and structuring your talking points. And so really, you know, investing a lot of time in making the pitch deck really simple as possible, as clear as possible. It's just a really high leverage investment of your time. And so I think focusing on that, the thing that was maybe more specific to us is that basically, you know, our product is a very technical access management product, and the space that we're in is, you know, there's a lot of competitors, and it's a really complex space as well. And so I think for us, the key challenge was, you know, we were never going to come up with it like a Shark Tank pitch, you know, where like you could pitch literally anyone on this and they would totally understand, oh, that's exactly the problem you're solving in access management. Like, that's not the sort of like depth that we wanted. Mm-hmm. We wanted to like have some amount of technical explanation in the pitch so that the sort of investors we were pitching would feel like they appreciated what we were doing, but we wouldn't go so into the weeds that, you know, we would just totally lose them. And so striking that balance for us was like one of the core challenges, I think, of like crafting the Series A narrative.
Mm-hmm. Right. So at this point, I think I just have to ask this question about Opal. Yeah. Because you mentioned that you have multiple other competitors. And I had a question about the name of the company and specifically the choice of the name of the company. When I was looking you up on Crunchbase, I had to double check with your LinkedIn to see the logo of your company to make sure I'm clicking on the right Opal, because there were like 15 of them, literally. Same name. Why did you choose the name Opal? What was the reasoning behind it?
Yeah, this is, you know, I did have a philosophy on this. So basically, okay. Yeah. So a lot of our competitors have names that, you know, sound like some, you know, like geek basically came up with the name, and they're very, uh-huh. they're very cyber sounding. And I think a lot of security tools, you know, the sort of like, you know, consumerization of SaaS that's like happened, you know, where people started by using Facebook, and then they would go, you know, use like their workplace software, and that workplace software did not offer as good of a user experience. And so, you know, that drove a lot of like, you know, a lot of the things that, you know, we learned in consumer tech kind of came over to enterprise SaaS. But I think security like has been, you know, kind of one of the last holdouts of that. And a lot of security tools are still like very clunky. And so we wanted a name that like, you know, connoted like some amount of elegance, and also, you know, like just didn't want a name that sounded like too much like a tech company. And so what I actually did, which is super random, you know, so I think a lot of the words in English that sound really good are words that are like derived from basically like Latin. And specifically like French. And so I basically pulled up a Wikipedia page of like all the English words that were like had a French origin or a Latin origin. And just from that list, just like, you know, my co-founder and I picked like 10 that we thought sounded nice and then kind of just filtered it down to Opal. But yeah, there are definitely some like SEO challenges of like having a pretty generic name. And there being a lot of different like opals in a lot of different spaces. So yeah, that's definitely a challenge, but I've actually been really happy with the name all in all. I like how it sounds. It's like simple. It doesn't sound too much like a tech company and it sounds like nice and elegant. So.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. I just, my approach to creating names is so different. I just come up with a name. I Google it. If there are too many of them, I'm just like, nah, you know what? That's taken. I'm just going to move on.
Yeah.
SEO in mind from day one. On this note, let's move on to the very last question of today's episode, which is a call to action. So Stephen, what do you want the listener to do as soon as the episode is over?
Say it one more time, Constantine.
Once the episode is over, what do you want the listener to do?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I spent a lot of time at a big company, and I have to say my life is definitely more stressful as a startup founder. But you know, I feel a lot more fulfillment, I would say, in general. And so, to the extent that like, yeah, anyone's on the fence about, you know, like taking the plunge, like, you know, everyone says this, but you'll never feel ready to do it. And so it's kind of, I feel like for most of us, it has to be a leap of faith that we just take and do it. And I think one thing that really helps is just like, you know, identifying someone in your life that could be like a really good co-founder. And I think that in the same way that having a gym buddy helps motivate you to go to the gym, like having a potential co-founder, can really help make this like really big life decision to go into startup world a lot easier. So finding that person, I guess, would be the call to action for those who are considering entering startup world and haven't yet.
Absolutely. Solo founders very frequently are extremely sad. So definitely go for it. Even founders who are doing great together, horrible stories have hurt my ears. So be careful there. Take your time, you know, think about it, think about going through some tough times, and yeah, go for it. Then that's a very optimistic call to action. I love it. Thank you for that, Stephen. On this note, we're gonna wrap it up. My call to action is gonna be extremely simple. As usually, check out the description of this episode. I'm gonna include a bunch of links in there. There's gonna be a link to Opal, of course. There's gonna be a link to two books that Stephen mentioned, Founder's Dilemma and Never Split the Difference. So if you're curious about those, definitely check it out. And of course, there's going to be my shameless personal plugin, which is the course that Fundraising Radio Team is developing right now. So if you're looking to fundraise, if you're looking to start your company, check out the description of this episode. And as usually, have a good day.